And welcome to session 11.3, the Arts and Working Class Activity. And I'm moderator Jim Cassidy. If the presenters would introduce themselves, start right here. Hi.
I'm Ruth Myers. I'm a teaching American Studies at SUNY Buffalo, and I'm also working with the Coalition for Engineering Justice. And I'll be presenting on a community video project from our local media arts organization called CPVO, where they match film makers with local organizations to tell stories and helping grassroots activism in the city.
And hello.
Hi, I'm Carol Corp, and I teach at SUNY Old Westbury, which is just down the road. And I teach American Studies and also Media Studies. And I'll tell you the title of my work later, but it's part of a book that's called Camera Work, Miss Topography in America's Working Class, from 1919 to 1950, that I'm working on to send off to a publisher in
January. Hi, I'm John Hubrex. I teach at Framingham State College in Massachusetts in the History Department. And this is my first post-book project. My book, which is on sale, actually, needs to be blogging. is over there. It's on railroad labor, but work today that I'm presenting with my colleague is on New Deal Post Office art that was created in the Post Office agreement.
I'm Erica Schneider. I also teach at Framingham State College, and I teach art history. So I'm the art component of the
And a late addition to our schedule.
I'm Vanessa Hahn, assistant professor of English at your City College of Technology or City Tech. I'm presenting at Raymond Carver. I was in another panel, it's a panel, but so we'll let
Okay. There we go. And you can hold your questions till the end of the session. I appreciate it.
They were trying to get those off before, and those might be maybe safe.
Okay, let's try this then, just so we get the full flavor of our instruments. That works.
Okay, the late 19th, early 20th century philosopher and educator John Dewey said the moral function of art itself is to remove prejudice, do away with the scales that keep the eye from seeing, tear away the veils due to want and custom, perfect the power to perceive. Dewey had high expectations for art, and the architects of the New Deal's various art programs held similar lofty expectations. In 1933, the average American had never experienced an original piece of art, and artists were often seen as social outsiders engaged in the production of arcane, perhaps even obscene objects. The federal government's New Deal programs challenged the notions of art as sacred and sought to dispel the myth that artists were not legitimate workers, making art available to all Americans by putting it in public spaces would change the relationship between artists and society by democratizing both art and American culture. Edward Bruce, head of the Treasury Department section of fine arts, wrote that the objective of public art should be to enrich the lives of Americans. He concluded that the dividends would be, quote, fostering all the simple pleasures of life, which are not important in terms of dollars spent, but are immensely important in terms of higher standard of living. The amount of art created by various New Deal programs is indeed impressive. Artists employed by the Works Progress Administration created 2,566 murals. Artists working for the Treasury Department added another 1,116 murals to federal buildings. A staggering 108,000 easel paintings were created. Sculptors contributed more than 18,000 works, and thousands of prints were made from more than 11,000 designs, all created by New Deal artists. It is not clear exactly how many of these pieces are still in existence, or if they are, how many people even know what they are. And parenthetically, I was at a library doing research for this, and I pointed out a print on the wall behind the reference librarian, and he said, I always wondered where that came from. And reference librarians usually know everything about everything, so I was surprised by that. At any rate, this presentation seeks to draw preliminary conclusions based on murals that appear on post office walls in Massachusetts. I would add briefly that because we are beginning this project, we chose to examine images that were easily accessible to Erica and I. The geographic scope may increase as we progress, and Erica will discuss some of these images in greater detail during her portion of the presentation. The murals offered many Americans the chance to experience original art for the first time, and because they often portrayed the ideal, like the arrival of the train service in Ashland, and that's the photo we have here, it helped Americans to restore a sense of nationalism and exceptionalism that the Great Depression had taken out of America and contributed to the decline of some people's ideas, if you will. In September 2009, conservative personality and Fox News political commentator Glenn Beck heartily railed against 1920s and 30s art on display in Rockefeller Center in New York City. In his examination, Beck pointed out the connections between oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller and current Democratic Senator from West Virginia, J. Rockefeller IV. Beck described the images as proof of a liberal plot against the United States. Beck, leaping from morphed hammers and sickles to perceived manifestations of Mussolini, proved communism continues to impair innocent citizens today. Erica will discuss that image in a moment. I'm just amused that he's linking Mussolini with communism, and he also seems to have forgotten John Jr. and Ludlow, but we'll let Glenn go because he's like that. While some of the images portray the senior side of American history, like slavery and the decimation of Native populations, at the same time, these images enforce racial stereotypes and conventions of the period. To ensure a mural's acceptability, both the WPA and the local postmaster had to approve it. Complicating the process, artists were often not local and had to employ esoteric historical references to try to incorporate that to get their commission accepted by the WPA or the Treasury Department. The Great Depression shook Americans' faith in the nation and its institutions. The Depression was even more shocking because it came after a decade of relative prosperity, which saw production rise, a vast expansion of consumerism, and unemployment that perhaps averaged less than 5% after 1924, for the last half of the decade. As people came to understand the magnitude of the downturn, they lost their sense of uniqueness, and they suddenly felt vulnerable. The art created by the New Deal was, in the end, mostly a palliative for the nation. While some of it depicts historical reality as prescribed by the cultural norms of the era, for instance, segregation and portrayals of women's bodies very much fit stereotypes of the day, much of it focuses on idealistic images and history the way Americans preferred to remember it. We started this project before Beck's remarks, so our purpose is not to refute him, but rather to put these images into what we believe is a more accurate historical context. Art projects were not originally part of the New Deal. George Biddle was to become the, in quotes, father of the federal arts projects. He was a schoolmate at both Groton and Harvard of President Roosevelt. He was a talented artist who possessed also a strong social conscience. Like others, he believed that since the turn of the century, about appreciation for art had been slowly increasing in the United States and could be accelerated by placing easily understood art before the public. The art experiment in Mexico in the 1920s, where artists were paid a small salary from the government to create what some critics have argued is the greatest national school of mural painting since the Italian Renaissance, greatly influenced Biddle. In May 1933, he wrote Roosevelt suggesting that the time was ideal for some kind of government-sponsored program. FDR asked Biddle to speak with the Treasury Department because the Treasury oversaw most of the federal buildings. The federal government established the Public Works for Art project, run through the Treasury Department in the fall of 1933. Edward Bruce, who shared Biddle's vision for art, served as the administrator. Although the PWAP was housed in the Treasury, the projects were funded by the Civil Works Administration, whose director, Harry Hopkins, gave Bruce more than $1 million to pay for artists. There was little leadership from Washington, so much of the initiative came from the local level, and it had essentially ceased to function by the end of 1934. While the program revealed no new geniuses in the art world, it employed nearly 3,700 artists who created hundreds of pieces of art, many of which ended up in government buildings. For example, more than 450 ended up in the House of Representatives office building in Washington, D.C. The government's patronage of art did not end in 1934. Bruce managed to secure powerful allies in Washington, including Eleanor Roosevelt and Henry Morgenthau's wife. He was the Secretary of the Treasury. She was a big supporter of him. And by the fall of 1934, the Treasury Department created the Section of Painting and Sculpture, which underwent numerous name changes during the New Deal. It's usually just referred to as the Section. The task of the Section was to secure art for new federal buildings. Traditionally, the architect had chosen the art, but with the implementation of these new programs, that duty now fell on the Treasury Department to choose the art instead of the architect to go into new federal buildings. A second significant New Deal art initiative began in 1935 with the creation of the Federal Art Project, one of several cultural components of the Works Progress Administration, which Roosevelt signed in August of 1935 as part of the Second New Deal. Prior to the Great Depression, art in the United States was thought to be the domain of a cultural elite. The New Deal cultural program sought to not only employ the unemployed, but also to shift the power away from the elites and, through democracy, place greater power in the hands of ordinary citizens. The New Deal's cultural programs aim to desacralize art and artistic production and make cultural capital more accessible to the American public by challenging art's sacred aura and integrating it into everyday life. Holger Cahill was selected to head the Federal Art Project. Cahill and Bruce, although rivals in some respects for federal money, were both committed to the idea that art could have a leavening effect on the nation in the midst of arguably the worst crisis in its history. They were also committed to bringing art into the mainstream of American life. That concludes my portion now. Erica will talk about some of the images.
Now I want to examine specific examples of New Deal art. Returning to our contentious commentator, one sec. I'm just going to show one of the images. He highlighted two figures by Paul Genoway. He didn't identify any of them. Flanking a doorway, identified them as representations of workers. In the 1937 work titled Industry and Agriculture, the man with the sledgehammer represents urban industry, while the one standing next to wheat and holding a sickle symbolizes agrarian pursuits. when juxtaposed as such, become symbols of American prosperity. Unmistakable as the national symbols of communism, the ominous hammer and sickle of Russia are also just standard images of the worker that appear throughout the art of the 1930s across Russia, Europe, and America. Predictably, sensationalist sex perception of New Deal art created under the auspices of the Federal Art Project still raises questions about how such images are and were perceived. In many post office commissions from this period, the image of the worker abounds, as in Oranzio Mazzarelli's silver plaster release, Builders of Orange, from 1939. Like many of the artists employed by the section, Martorelli responded to the town's own history and thus focused on the textile worker paired with the farmer. Orange was a major mill town and farming community.
Could you say what state?
These are all in Massachusetts. So our focus is Massachusetts. Yeah, John had mentioned that all.
Okay.
So the ones I'm focusing on, the first one was New York, and that was in his backyard. But yeah, Ashland was Massachusetts. So in Orange was a major mill town and farming community in the 19th century. Leslie Artist places a female figure before a spinning wheel brandishing a yarn scheme instead of featuring, say, the 1860 Pemberton Mill collapse. And next to a man who raises a sickle in front of a corn stalk as opposed to an impoverished farmer, say, from the Dust Bowl. The classically allegorical figures combined with the proud American eagle demonstrate a conservative but not intentionally incendiary art. Public perception often greatly differed from the art historical perception of art created for the post offices during the 1930s and 40s. Current popular taste guided the decisions of the post office commission. Despite the advent of modernism in Europe, artistic styles with government projects tended toward realism. Therefore, the art styles, which seem so closely linked to contentious art today, as evidenced by Beck's rating, were actually quite traditional. The New Deal artists espoused the regionalist style, which aggrandized the nostalgia of the agrarian works at the time of the Dust Bowl was displacing the American farmer. Far less threatening than modern abstraction, regionalism sought to placate a public ravaged by the effects of the Great Depression, as evidenced in the 1930 American Today murals for the School of Social Research in New York City by Thomas Hart Benton. In Seal, his elongated figures burst with energy as they bend and pull in his fire-spewing machines. The bodies seem to undulate unnaturally, like those of Laocoon and his sons by the 17th century mannerist painter El Greco. Along with admiring El Greco, Benton also revered the brawny figures of Michelangelo. As an outspoken critic of European modernism, Benton purposely chose to revisit Renaissance models. At a time of avant-garde art styles such as Fauvism, Cubism, Synchronism, and Expressionism, Benton and his fellow regionalists rejected the more abstracted version of the world in favor of a more recognizable representation. As Benton bemoaned, "I wallowed in every cockeyed ism that came along, and it took me 10 years to get all that modernist dirt out of my system." The government would express similar convictions. Elizabeth Tracy's Elizabeth Tracy's 1937 mural Suffolk Resolved, Oppression and Revolt in the Colonies in the Milton, Massachusetts post office also features a sickle-wielding individual. Instead of threatening the 20th century capitalists, this was a revolt against the British Redcoats, as represented by the Boston Massacre on the left. Here, the sickle has a nostalgic resonance with the 19th century. After all, the farm machinery that replaced the individual worker had led to the erosion of topsoil and subsequent dust bowl. On the right, his compatriots, man and cannon load a gun and raise a pitchfork. In the center, three men debate what action needs to take place to protest the tyranny, specifically the intolerable acts. Paul Revere brought the resulting demands, known as the Suffolk Resolved, to the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia. Drafted in Milton, in a house that now houses the Milton Historical Society, the results were instrumental in articulating the complaints of the colonists as they surged toward revolution. When the section commissioned Tracy to create her work, the government representatives indicated their subject and stylistic preferences. Superintendent of the section, Edward B. Rowan, wrote, "It is suggested to use subject matter which embodies some idea appropriate to a post office or to the particular locale of Boston. What we want most is a simple and vital design." The Cambridge artist chose this historic event with resonance for both Milton and America. Stylistically like regionalism, the figures are monumental in size and proportion to the rest of the setting. The specific figural and compositional devices particularly echo Benton's work. The bodies twist and bend to the edges of the lunette shape dictated by the space, while the separate vignettes feature individual stories. After the section accepted the color preparatory work, Rowan continued to emphasize the government's mission. He urged, "It would be well for you to work on continued simplicity and clarity." He even suggested removing some of the figures. Upon completion, the postmaster added to his assessment, writing, "It is my personal opinion that the mural is a fine addition to a splendid building. The superintendent has informed me that competent art critics who have viewed the mural say that it is very good. There has also been very favorable reaction among the patrons of the office." Thus, the mural pleased the postmaster, critics, and patrons as intended. Today, the mural greets all who visit the Milton post office, but not everyone agrees on the artist's intentions. Last week, when I was there, I was taking pictures, and I was getting all sorts of opinions about this this work from, I've never seen this before, noticed it. So one visitor commented that other murals like this across the state and across the country have been removed, and I said, "Well, why is that?" He responded, "Well, you know, all these artists were communists." One of the employees reported that some people have asked for the mural's removal because of its depiction of violence, and so that's what's upsetting them in this one. In contrast to sentimentalized imagery as seen in the Ashland post office, which I showed in the first image when John was speaking, some Massachusetts post office murals have an even more checkered past. For example, Henry Billings' Golden Triangle Trade from 1939 in the Bedford post office has upset at least one contemporary patron. The mural's central image depicts a half-nude African-American carrying sugar cane with shackles at his feet, while an enthusiast Caucasian trader leans on a pier. Panels depicting sugar refinery and rum distillery equipment on either side complete the elements of the 18th century trade route. The resulting molasses from the sugar cane made Medford famous for its rum for almost two centuries. Anecdotal evidence indicates that this is an image from history somewhat forget. One viewer thought to have the mural removed in 1992 and even contacted the local chapter of the NAACP. In 1999, another viewer reiterated these concerns. When I saw the mural, I was horrified. We were considered livestock. What message are we sending our young black children? However, a 1992 committee meeting had already determined that most people wanted the mural to remain, this time a viewer reason. They wanted to sweep history under the rug. The record of the artist and the period should be recalled as part of Medford's history and as part of American history. People may find the mural upsetting, but they also recognize that it encapsulates history. Hollis Holbrook's John Elliott speaks to the Native Indians from 1937, and the Native Post Office has also attracted controversy. The work depicts 17th century Puritan missionary John Elliott next to five chained Native Americans in closer detail. Elliott created the first Bible in the Native Algonquin language and established Christian towns for the Native people, so-called praying Indians. However, when King Philip's War began in 1675, the colonists, fearing that Natives' loyalties returned, removed them to Deer Island, where they faced starvation and disease due to a lack of supplies. Many were even sold into slavery to pay for the cost of war. Holbrook chose his image based on books and accounts that he had read. The unsettling art, as one Boston Globe writer called the Native mural in 2004, continues to distress patrons, from its focus on the barbaric treatment of the Native Americans to the partial nudity of many of the figures, including one of the central males, as you can see, too, sort of breastfeeding and another bare-breasted woman on the side there. Many people visit the post office just to see the work, from classes at Wellesley College to Native American tribes, and both groups see the work as part of history. Despite calls for its removal, the mural was recently restored. According to a longtime employee, the mural always provokes a reaction, from outrage to admiration. As one reporter wrote, a few years ago, a Native woman wrote a letter to the editor proclaiming the mural offensive and demanding it to be removed. Her letter brought loud objections for those who believe we should look at our history with eyes open instead of painting over it. Well, even with the racist reminder of the injustice done to Native Americans, patrons still want the art to stay. From revolutionaries to slaves, session artists tackled controversial subjects. Rather than a lurking communist come to incite revolt, the figures instill confidence in a prosperous past and future. The government fully vetted each and every artist. By the time an artist began work at the post office, he or she had undergone a comprehensive selection process, submitted a preliminary sketch, and completed a full-scale cartoon. The government did not want any surprises. Today, most people react positively to the murals, despite this examples I've shown. In the rare times when the public objects, what they seem to mind most is not communism so much, but the stereotypes, the nudity, and the violence. Thank you.
Unions and businesses and media corporations
their representation of organized labor in news photography from 1919 through about 1950 or so. And so this is just a smidgen of a chapter, and I titled it, and I realized the title needs to be reworked because I used the word diversity, and that is so not a 1930s word, so I'm going to be looking for a new title. It was currently titled the United Nations in One Union Shop, Local 65, Distributive Workers Union, and Representing Diversity. And I also need to let you know some of these images are pretty horrific and in the process of securing rights for images right now, so the quality of some of these images today will not be as strong as I would like. In 1943, 261 Local 65 workers at Optical Research, along with a few of their bosses, lined up to donate blood for the war effort. The drive didn't go without a hitch. African American members at first refused to donate. An African American physician, Charles Drew, developed blood banking, but the American Red Cross insisted on segregating blood. In an era where blood purity remained a social obsession, the union organized against this. They organized a petition drive demanding an end to this practice. Local 65 photographers would further the union's anti-racist message in a picture of a later blood drive. The union paper New Voices showed member Ben O. Nordheimer on the left, a white man, and Eunice Tucker, a black woman, donating blood. In Union Solidarity spelled out in blood, the two lie side by side, Nordheimer's arm cradled Tucker's, their fraternal ties unequivocal. This photo is just one example of how Local 65, a New York City-based union, used photographs captured by its own member photographers to advance union ideals, in this case, racial and gender egalitarianism. Local 65 began as a handful of warehouse workers at H.X. Steams, which was a hosiery and white goods wholesaler, which was underwear, on the Lower East Side's Orchard Street in 33. 20 years later, the union constituted one of the largest locals in the New York area with about 18,000 members. The union's member-run paper, New Voices, and its photo staff documented and contributed to Local 65's growth. Early on in 1937, members suggested a very unusual union activity, which was a camera club for this union. The club set up a borrowing library and ran outings and nature hikes for picture-taking opportunities. It also constructed, quote, the most modern darkroom of any trade union in New York City. Might have been the only darkroom. I heard that the transport workers had one, but I haven't been able to get much evidence on this. At some point in 1938, New Voices editor, Jack Paley, bought a press camera and convinced members to take pictures for the New Voices. The member photographers became known as the New Voices photo staff. The photo staff disparaged the camera club members' Central Park shops and scoffed at Ashcan School iconography, which was referring to the New York-based artists of the teens whose work explored the difficulties and vitality of working-class urban life. Neither were they interested in the avant-garde experiments in composition or photomontage advocated by radical photographers abroad. This is the New Voices photo staff. And I think you can see they are very concerned with composition in their photographs. The photo staff believed their distinctive mission was, quote, objectively and, quote, documenting union life as photojournalists. In 1946, photographer Noel Weinstein said, quote, we had to see for 25,000 people, and it's no cinch. Former photo staff chair Ed Roth concurred, you're a witness for God knows how many people. Photo staff felt a deep sense of responsibility both to the union and to worker struggles. The result was a vital paper. Barney Cole, who was a freelancer for Popular Photography magazine, which was a mass market magazine in this time period, argued Paley's intelligent journalism and photographer's enthusiasm was a combination of hostile to be. He criticized most labor papers as monotonous, and to be honest, I'm not supposed to say that, but I can't look at my union paper today. Even though I know they must spend a fair amount of money, right, on the images, but you don't actually want to look at it a lot of the time. They usually consist of a picture of one of the union leaders, a cheesecake shot of some bathing beauty from Florida, and a shot or two of a meeting. The result is deadly, one issue hardly distinguishable from another. New Voices was instead, he said, quote, one of the best union papers in the country, excelling particularly in its photographic layouts. In 1953, The Nation
nationally rated new voices, quote, outstanding in the labor press. And they compared it with the very well-financed papers of the AFL, the CIO, and Steel Labor. And these are national papers, not local papers. New voices photographs have what I call an organizing eye that entice workers into struggle, educated them about collective action, and modeled activities for campaign success. Pictures promoted ideals for members, both as a collective and for individuals. And today what I'm going to be looking at is how photographers represented the union as a haven of racial, ethnic, and gender diversity. And let me tell you just a little bit about Local 65 for those of you who may know nothing about it. I actually knew people in the 80s who worked for it. It became part of the UAW over the course of the 80s, and it was known at that point in time as being a union that just organized everyone, daycare workers, people in colleges, et cetera. And it began that way. That was the way it envisioned itself from 1933 on. The challenges to building this union were many. The early members were observant Jews, many of them, with ethnic or familial ties to their bosses, which made them somewhat suspicious of joining a union. These workers had dead-end jobs, and that's what their union president called them, jobs that kids took when they got out of school. A lot of young, upwardly mobile Jews were forced into these jobs in the midst of the Depression. Their career hopes were dashed. Nonetheless, they weren't necessarily interested in devoting a lot of time to a job that ultimately they didn't care too much about sticking in. The industry structure produced further barriers to organization. Distributive workers toiled in a very atomized industry. These shops were very tiny. You might have a larger warehouse of about 100 workers, and ultimately they would go on to organize Bloomingdale's and other department stores. But many of the shops had just two or three workers, very tiny, tiny shops. And so to build solidarity in these shops and to get enough economic pressure to put upon the boss, you needed to draw out all your members in support of other workers. Over time, the workforce's increasing heterogeneity posed new challenges. In 35, the union expanded into more ethnically diverse shops, which they left the sort of Orchard Street area. By the war years, a quarter of its membership was African American. Growing numbers of women also joined Local 65. In 1937, women were about a quarter of the membership. By World War II, they were half of the membership. So it was a very diverse union. In a 68 interview, Arthur Osmond, the president, reminisced, Local 65 could not survive unless it involved the total membership in struggle. We had to have 100% participation. So the way they did this, by and large, was by, quote, making 65ers feel like 65ers. They did a lot of cultural and social activities for their membership, the scale and the scope of which I think is pretty unparalleled for a union. They funded new voices in the first year. They had sort of typical kinds of things, baseball games, boat trips up the Hudson, an education committee that had labor history classes, et cetera. The union sponsored, this is actually a figure of their scheduling board. It's kind of a boring picture, but what's interesting about the picture is that it appeared over and over and over again in New Voices. And so I think they were signaling to their membership that the activities that take place in this union headquarters are crucial to the life of the union. That's why it was such an iconic photograph. Here's a photograph of their lending library. They had regular dances. They held pageants at Madison Square Garden, and they ultimately had their own penthouse nightclub. Osmond's expansive, culturally driven unionism and the distributed workers' avid response have a lot of different explanations. I think I'm going to go quickly through this so we can see some more pictures. But one of the things is that they needed to keep the union together, and so this was one way to really develop unity and solidarity among the members. They also raised significant funds for the union, particularly their dances. Many of the members were familiar from socialism and from the workmen's circle with this notion that workers deserved a rich cultural life. And this is a New York City-based union, and there's so many popular front activities in New York City at this point in time. Many of the members, not all, but many of the members, and particularly the leaders, were also members of the Communist Party
And so though they were not apt to sort of tout it about, as one scholar of the Union says, from A to Z, there's not a piece of the communist agenda that's missing from their work. So they were a very engaged union, and I think when we think about the Popular Front, their activities fit in line with that as well. This also explains our interest in photography. The New York Photo League members and Friday Photographers, which are both Popular Front efforts, gave hands-on training to Local 65 members. And Sid Grossman, who's less well-known Photo League member, but Robert and Cornell Kappa, who are two other influential members. Cornell Kappa went on to found the International Center for Photography on 6th Avenue, and Robert Kappa took a famous photograph of the Spanish Civil War soldier who sort of fallen backward that was seen in Life magazine. They hung out at District 65 and gave training to their members. This is a photo actually from one of the Photo League members, Aaron Smith. Local 65's fighting army comprised a diverse lot, men and women, black and white, and a host of ethnicities. Success demanded a wide-armed embrace of all. The leaders and members' sensitivity to anti-Semitism and to xenophobia and their communist ties also strengthened their resolve to be an agent of change in racial and gender relations. And I think they used the camera to further those goals. And we'll see a little bit of what they do, but my argument here is that in general, photographs and voices presented women and African Americans as co-creators and co-recipients of Union life. They didn't actually mark them as distinct kinds of beings that much, which is the way they're being marked in popular culture at this time, and actually often the way they're even being marked in other Union publications. Local 65 emerged as a leader for racial equality among unions. At the 36th AFL convention, Obama pushed the foot-dragging craft unions to desegregate. They would go on to join the CIO a year or two after this fact. Leaders and members championed the Scottsboro Boys, rallied for anti-lynching legislation, and fought for African-American and Jewish employment at the 1939 World Fair. They rallied against white rioters in Detroit in 43 and in Cicero in 51, and in the early 50s, they mobilized close to 4,000 members against segregation at MetLife's model apartment community, Stuyvesant Town. The union's demands for gender equality, I don't believe, were as thoroughgoing. It pushed for comparable work, which is somewhat unusual in this time period. The union pushed for it, but it wasn't necessarily something the union pushed at this time. And it made familial and domestic concerns, such as rent and food prices, central to the union agenda. Local 65 sensitivity to these gendered community concerns, as historians call them, was unusual. However, the union didn't really question women's subsidiary role in society or in the home. And in some instances, they actually blamed women, believing that they didn't try hard enough, or they should stop knitting at their meetings, and then maybe people would take them a little bit more seriously. There's a variety of ways in which the union pushed egalitarianism at the worksite and internally. They had a hiring call. If a company didn't want to hire a worker, an African-American worker or a woman, they would send two people, a black person and a white person, and insist that both were hired. They would only send African-Americans until they hired someone. And women themselves, actually, the union sort of celebrated workers' only anti-racist efforts at Gimbel's, for example. Waitresses insisted that black women must be allowed to waitress, so breaking down the institutional racism that kept black women in the kitchen and white women in the front of the house. So the union sort of celebrated this in the paper. They diversified their staff and leadership around racial, gender, and ethnic lines. And they had top leaders, both women and African-American. They paid attention to their leadership. And it's not as if there was proportional leadership to membership, but they pushed to make it better in all instances. And for any of those of you who are aware of sort of union history in the 30s through the 50s, this is not something that other unions did. Even the ILG, for example, worked really hard to keep African Americans and Puerto Ricans from important leadership positions and women from important leadership positions in the same time period. So they used cultural pluralism as a way to meld people together.
At the most basic level, they celebrated their heterogeneous membership. A caption for a photo of the Empire State Glass decorating section, United Nations in a local 65 shop, greeted members from Puerto Rico, Italy, Russia, China, Britain, Germany, and Poland. National affairs groups at the union affirmed ethnic cultures and built inter-ethnic solidarity. They had things like the Irish Easter celebration, which commemorated Doug Flynn's Easter uprising. They had Italian fiestas, they had Negro, Spanish, and Jewish affairs dances, and you can actually see pictures of them dancing under banners that say no discrimination, which is kind of wonderful, kind of mixed group of people dancing under these banners. They had a bilingual paper by the late 1940s, La Voz Hispana, and they held classes both on women's history and African American history. Other unions, again, often pander to their members' racism. So I've done some work on steelworkers, and in some instances, steelworkers, locals, wouldn't have women's auxiliaries because they didn't think they could have dances, and they could all come together in sort of mixed race, mixed gender groups. So I think we can see how expansive this union was. Local 65 was very different. Said one white man, when I joined, Bob Ackerman, when I joined Local 65, the only Jew I felt was a dead one. Once I went to a dance where there were Negroes and whites and I couldn't take it, I ran out of the place. Today I know 20 Negroes out here who would give their arms to save my rights, and the same with the Jews. I learned to hate when I was a kid, but I've learned different in Local 65. Women members applauded Local 65 for challenging subtle forms of discrimination, such as a woman's age or looks, that would help hold them back on the jobs. New voices depicted their membership, men and women, black and white, to further their egalitarian goals. And new voices, the color of one's skin did not color one's representation. New voices' photos wanted the union's diversity. Local 65 photographers integrated black and white members in its photos of crew meetings and picket lines. At a time when de facto Jim Crow kept northern whites and blacks from socializing, both groups mingled in photos, such as this one of their band practice. Photos of dances in the union hall or dinners at its supper club showed African Americans and white couples joined together in fun. And New Voices printed photos of Negro History Exhibition where mixed crowds of black and white members examined African American contributions to the nation's past. And I'm sorry, they had a great page, but it was really hard to see Thurgood Marshall coming to visit one of the Negro exhibitions that they did. Other unions' photos of job actions or social events were monochromatic, with few pictures of blacks and whites working, picketing, or playing together. And photos of women or African Americans often joined articles that were attempting to prove union attempts at diversification. So SWAP, which had had real problems in 1919 because of its incapacity to sort of reach out to different groups, did reach out to African Americans in the 1930s with their drive. And they utilized photographs to show this off. And the ILG, the same thing. But these were, I think, more window dressing photographs than actual attempts at thoroughgoing integration within the union. This is a photo from SWAP, Counting Women to Show the Way. The women, it's interesting because the women have a lot of decorum in this photograph. SWAP tended to show its white women members as sort of sexy babes or attractive women. So I found the gendering of this photo particularly interesting. Of course, how unions imagine workers was way better than the popular culture at this point in time, right? So this is a famous image from Gone from the Wind, with the mammy figure. The next photo I'm going to show is very painful. This appeared in Life magazine in the late 1930s, and not only did it appear once, but this is also on the cover of Exile on Main Street, for those of you who know this from the show and tell. This picture appeared at least three or four times. They printed it once, and then members, or not members, but readers, kept on again and again sending it back and commenting on the picture, and each time they'd reprint it, which I thought someone like needs to explore this. Anyway, as late as the late 40s, a picture of a woman hugging Billy Eckstein would be something that Life magazine would decide, they're not sure that they could print this. You know, this sort of challenges the racial boundaries too much. The Hearst Syndicate fired a photographer for going to Harlem and taking pictures of black and white kids together in this same time period. So for this union to show images of blacks and whites working and playing together is a very radical act. Here's one of their socials. Here is a black woman on top and a white man on the bottom. The image is almost exactly the same of the men on the picket line. Let me show you just a few images of women working. This is, because my argument here is that they weren't as egalitarian when it came to women. They definitely show women as pinup objects in their magazine, and they had regular contests to see who the most beautiful woman was, although women didn't always respond. In fact, women sometimes got very angered about this. For one contest, they had to keep on sending out letters like, where are the beautiful women? Why aren't you participating in this? This is the lone way in which, however, I think women are marked as distinct in this journal. They often show men and women in couples. People got married in this union a lot. I think it's because it was a very intense union life. This is an image of a strike that took place in 1937 that Life magazine did. In this image, we see women having fun, playing. The last sheet, which I'm not showing you, actually shows women putting their makeup on, because that's what women like to do. Life liked to show women in their underwear. Here you've got a woman striker who's sort of shorn of her skirt on the upper side there, basically not taking women workers very seriously. Here we have women as objects, not in a horrific sort of way, as steel labor was wont to show them. Again, similar to what we saw with District 65. Some images, like Rosie, of women, but never sort of narrowed into only that image, which I thought was important. Another very common way women are depicted in the 1930s is maternalist. You guys all know this image. This is Dorothea Lange's Migrant Mother. This is a steel labor image that's exactly like that. District 65 didn't do that. I've got two more pictures of that. District 65 didn't do that. District 65 took women as active agents seriously. It tended not to see them in just a particular way. Another very common image of labor in the 1930s was this sort of masculinized image of labor. Elizabeth Fowle has talked about the ways in which in the ILG, which had a predominant female membership, this kind of imagery was used all the time. Wouldn't really see this in District 65. Instead, you'd see women on the job, women on strikes, taken seriously as active members. And so what I argue, I'm still playing with the idea here, is that they have almost a kind of colorblind world, not a totally genderblind world, but somewhat of one. And that to do so in the 40s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, this really is a radical act for this union. Thank
My paper's at Raymond Carver. I'm assuming some of you are familiar with him. Very popular, influential short story writer of the 1970s, 1980s. He's been treated, up until the last decade or so, I would say by critics as primarily a formalist orientation. In the last decade, criticism has really changed, partially because the International Raymond Carver Society just brought together a group of scholars who are really interested in examining his life and work from a cultural studies perspective. So I think I've seen the criticism completely change. And I'm part of that change. I am the only person I'm aware of right now, really talking about him specifically in relationship to class and working class culture. There are a variety of reasons for that, which I'm going to get to. And I've been working this down. This is actually a boiled down version of a much longer essay that was part of my dissertation. I've since revised some of those essays from my dissertation and turned them into journal essays. This is much longer, much more complicated, and I'm hoping this is going to become the backbone of a book manuscript. So any feedback really would be appreciated.
Okay, this paper argues that narratives of the working class are central to Carver's work and to his appeal. Beyond these straightforward depictions of his people, Carver's stories engage cultural interests in the working class and appropriated common cultural narratives, capturing the imagined and lived realities of their lives with richness and detail. Carver's stories thereby complicate understandings of working class Americans during the decades under consideration. Analyzing Carver's life and work within the cultural context of the 1970s and 1980s will enable a more complex understanding of these decades, his life, and his story. At times, Carver's stories conform to mainstream representations of class, while at other times, his stories enrich the often static, ideologically motivated portrayals of working class people. It is commonplace among critics to point out Carver's and his character's status as working class. However, questions concerning how class status and experience may inform Carver's representation or differentiate them from middle class representation have received remarkably little attention. When addressed, Carver's class representations are generally treated as a novelty, an interesting deviation from the class background and the subject matter of other canonical American stylistic innovators. If not treated as a novelty, Carver's stories are treated as being universal in being. When treated by critics interested specifically in working class literature, he tends to be dismissed as lacking a clear vision of politics. The absence of sustained critical attention to class, and in fact the absence of cultural studies perspective of Carver criticism up until recently, alludes to both a critical proclivity to focus more on style and content Carver's story, and to a more general tendency to separate the economic from the cultural and cultural studies. This separation, spurred by the ascendancy of cultural studies in the 1970s over a more narrowly Marxist, class-based critique of culture, resulted in a kind of implicit separation between class and culture. Unconsciously, I believe, this is the attention to class mirrors what happened in the early 1980s, during what Lauren Rolant called the Reaganite Cultural Revolution, which devoted considerable effort to separating out considerations of the economic conditions of citizenship from questions of culture and subjectivity. A critical understanding of how Carver portrays the working class, contextualized within events of the 1970s and 80s, will provide a more nuanced understanding of both Carver's stories and the decades in which his stories were written and received critically acclaim. Carver established his voice as a preoccupation in the 1970s, a decade in which a constellation of blue-collar images surfaced popular culture for the first and only time since the 1930s, a cultural phenomenon entitled the 1970s Blue-Collar Index. This decade profoundly shaped his imagination for representation of American culture. However, Carver achieved celebrity during the 1980s, a period of diminishing representations of the working class, except perhaps for those flourishing in film as early Reaganist patriots, and of national transition understandings of the state as a more liberal, limited caregiver, into a much more austere and unilateral benefactor of corporations and wealthy. Carver's ability to flourish as one of the few cultural celebrities representing working class experiences of problems. While the 1980s dominant culture worked to obfuscate the problems of class, attests to Carver's ability to shape discourse to fit the preoccupations of his time, as well as his own role as a cultural influence. In an interview with Cassio Botti in 1988, Carver provided only published quotes specifically linking his work with the American political sphere. I write often comes about working class people on the dark side of race America. So in that regard, I propose the stories can be read as criticism as an indictment. He was a very self-consciously apolitical, he had a very self-consciously apolitical persona, which is subject of a whole other essay. Much of what makes Carver's story so powerful is his portrayal of working class characters undergoing personal emotional crises to which people of all classes can relate. Carver's stories also reference discourses and images of a working class who are late festival to most Americans in the 1970s and 80s. Carver was a master in engaging cultural codes in this story. I argue that readers recognize, even if only subliminally, cultural codes in a story. These codes are cultural discourses permeating stories and help shape readers' perception. Carver was not, however, unique among many of his contemporaries for a subject matter. Tentative critical titles for the group of writers dealing with similar subject matter included Dirty Realism, White Trash Fiction, and my favorite, post-alcoholic, blue-collar, minimalist hyper-realism. He was, however, remains the most widely recognized loosely constructed literary constellation of writers. John Bodmer's and Jefferson Cowley's scholarship attests that attention to the working class was a larger cultural preoccupation during the 1970s, when a group of writers, including Carver, Bobby M. Mason, and Frederick Bartlemy, made the first major publications in form of definitive style. Jefferson Cowley argues the 1970s was the decade that common people and the problem of class returned to commercial popular culture with extraordinary vitality.
and the 70s launch is one of the most vibrant discussions on the subject in the 20th century. In the academic realm, sociologists, including Bishop Senna, Jonathan Cox, Daniel Aronowitz, and William Rubin, tell the meaning experience of working class in the United States and the contingent of class. However, the blue-collar characters in mundane settings dominated for a time in the 1980s. Elite literary journals, including the New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, and Harper's, felt remarkable. This essay analyzes Carver's working class landscape and characters, situation in multiple circulating discourses of the working class during the 1970s and 80s. In addition to reading representations of Carver as stories, which I select for foregrounding working class subjects, this essay will also contribute to historical understanding of the working class representations of the 70s and 80s. My argument builds on Howes and Bonner's scholarship, positing that this attention to working class subjects is evidenced in Carver's work as reception, as well as in other cultural realms, extended to the 1980s. However, discourses concerning the working class were transformed and diminished by historical, economic, and political shifts between the two decades. Carver's stories not only mirrored, but shaped cultural discourses. The stories provide a valuable engagement with and corrected to the stereotypes of representation the working class is mired, most notably in the pantheon of discussion of the political and media constructed violent majority exploited by the Republican Party for votes in the 1970s and 1980s. So I really boiled down to, this is then the body of my essay starts. I'm just going to relate with some of the main currents that I track for in the rest of my essay. I analyzed the connection between Raymond Carver's stories and Bruce Springsteen's lyrics. You can't get away from the connection between Raymond Carver and Bruce Springsteen, although I initially was kind of queasy about that. But just briefly, I guess, like Carver, Springsteen's portrayal of America invoked blue-collar workers' despair, destructive relationships, and claustrophobic unit in small towns that became Rust Belt cities. Also, like Carver, Springsteen lyrically chronicles the destructive effects of the cities, the crisis of the 1970s, the Reaganomics, and the workers' lives. Carver's stories, like Springsteen's lyrics, blur this distinction, capturing a general cultural feeling of limitation and crisis, but linking this form with concrete economic and social stressors. The more refloating anxiety and alienation of the 1970s had strong ties to economic stressors that hit working class people particularly hard, and this is that refloating anxiety and alienation that Carver's stories are notable for portraying and capturing, but also affected people at all tiers of society. Both Carver's and Springsteen's work connected economic, national, and existential stress and the portrayals of individual lives. It helped make working class lives visible and sympathetic to middle class consumers of literature and music. Interestingly, while Carver is familiar with Bruce Springsteen's work, but Bruce Springsteen is also familiar with Raymond Carver's work. In fact, I've referenced him several times in interviews. I also focus on Carver's celebration of survival. That's probably one of the common themes in his short stories. And I argue that both capture the working class sensibility and the sensibility of the 1970s. I'm talking about how this, mainstream and this popular sensibility merged with this particular class sensibility as portrayed in the story. One of the themes I also traced was Carver's use of the Vietnam War, both as an incident in its own right for portraying his stories, but also the metaphor for his characters in battle circumstances. His story Vitamins goes even further in locating interlocking forms of oppression, linking war and class oppression, the gender and race relations with the United States. And I also argue that the discussion and treatment of victims and survivors can strip them of cultural context and need to examine them with economic and social inequality. Another thread that I examined is how Carver's treatments of work intersect with treatments of the working class in mainstream periodicals, both as labor during those decades, which is a problem, of course, the Time magazine that is prominent in mainstream periodicals, and as a silent majority, which is the right wing's pet of course, but how it kind of walks between these different discourses or navigates them. And I apologize for the trope of communication. Another thread I followed was the working class, how is his stories related to the working class or the construct of working class literature, or identity created by academic. And I discussed this uncomfortable fit with representations of class conscious workers. Carver stories complicated these portrayals. He's an uncomfortable figure for his interest in class and working class representation for that reason. He was an expressly and explicitly non-political person. And, I think there is a politics in the stories, but he certainly worked to downplay it. So you have to kind of think about that when you're looking ahead to find working class in literature. Another thread that I followed was his focus on the geographic solution. When he termed the geographic solution, which means, I guess, when things get tough, you get up and go. There's been a lot of stories. I believe he's a prominent working class. theme as well, and focus on the psychological effects of work that parallels and parallels Seth Circle's oral history. I talk about how Seth Circle's narrative, individual narratives of working, Carver has almost what you can see of literary working that focus on. You know, they don't directly mediate the other strengths of work oftentimes, but more about the psychological consequences of the kinds of work that they do. And Carver was very much interested in representing psychological realm as opposed to the work realm. He's also really interested just one of the places in Alaska. In the 1970s, it's funny, so I was going through a lot of magazines from that time period. Alaska is really imagined as a haven. I was refuge from the ills of the 1970s and so forth. And people imagine went up there and, you know, working on the oil rig and getting away from the problems that way. And so Alaska appears in several of Carver's stories. So that those are the dominant threads, this one more that in the body. And just in summary, Carver's short stories enrich our understanding of working class lives during the period when working class representations permeated into popular culture. Economic, political, and cultural crises of the 1970s and early 1980s created a context in which mainstream audiences readily related to voices on the economic margin. Their economic struggles as well as the more general confusion that attempts to comprehend the situation. The range and quality of working class images circulating during this period when Carver's work found an audience proves remarkable in recent years of U.S. history. After the mid-1980s, workers receded from the country's popular imagination, fading from television, film, and critically acclaimed literature. Charles McGrath notes that the disappearance of the working class, even more general issues of class mobility in popular cultural texts, that they disappeared from the cultural imagination. Although one would be tempted to interpret Carver's vision as despairing, it's important to note that part of the character's appeal is her openness place to serenity, understand, or escape from the situation. This attempt to know it's believable to be in the present and our time. The majority of Carver's characters are located in the same class that he was born into, somewhere between comfortable and sorry, as one of his poems describes. Factoring class and interpretation enriches an understanding of Carver's work, adding a depth and complexity of subjects that can appear, given the fair description, paratactic sentence structure, and absence of a controlling narrative voice, relatively devoid of context. The paratactic sentence structure of Carver's stories does not evidence the inability of Carver's characters to conceptualize or articulate, as David Kaufman argues in a very influential article. Correctly observing that Carver's stories demonstrate the depletion of older utopian horizons and a stunning comprehension many Americans felt in the 1970s and early 1980s, he mistakenly conflates this lack of coherent view of the world or vision of change in articulating it. Like Carver himself, Carver's characters are communicators and storytellers. The inarticulateness lies in their ultimate inability, as with Carver, to make sense of their experience. However, Carver's stories also spiral out of his authorial control, intersecting in fascinating ways with the politics and history of the era in which they are published, as well as the cultural issues of class, gender, and race, surfacing with the vengeance during the same time. Some of this resulted from Carver's keen eye, penchant for borrowing from people's lives and from his culture. Another part of this was chance, the events of his life, his tumultuous marriage and conflicted fatherhood, his attempts to maintain his ambition and dreams despite his self-defining work, who often reflect in the stories as soon as the mood of preoccupation at this time.
Lost almost 500,000 people. from the area, so there's huge, and as the industrial jobs left, which were mostly unionized and better paying, they've been replaced with a lot of service sector jobs and low-wage jobs, and so the incomes of the Buffalo people have fallen a great deal. So more than half of the folks living in poverty work, and there have been a lot of grassroots community efforts to try to address issues of poverty, of housing, of lack of literacy in the community, both for very young children. And I think the data is that children coming from poor families start school 18 months behind those coming from middle and upper income families. When you actually look at the kinds of grassroots efforts that are going on in Buffalo, that there are a lot of these efforts to like empower people to deal with and solve a lot of the problems that the city government and the county government is not dealing with. When you look at the kinds of solutions that the city government has come up with, they tend to be like these big, glamorous, silver bullet solutions, building a convention center, building more downtown hotels, do not invest money in the neighborhoods to rehabilitate housing. There's a big vacancy rate in housing, and you get a lot of abandoned housing, and so a lot of the government strategies to tear down housing rather than to look at what's salvageable and rehabilitated. So try four or five different organizations and then try to show you two clips from two groups that are dealing with housing, trying to rehabilitate housing and at the same time provide jobs and training for low-income residents in two of Buffalo's poor communities. So the two poor communities, one is on the east side and it's predominantly African-American, and there it's been way hit hard by the loss of the major employers in Buffalo, which didn't always provide the highest wages, but even the smaller manufacturers with less cook jobs that paid up to poverty wages, perhaps, or slightly above. And again, a lot of the service sector jobs don't come close to providing poverty wages or being able to support families at poverty levels or above. The other community is more diverse. It's on the west side of Buffalo, and it's more of a mix of African American, Latino, a lot of recent immigrants, a couple of influxes of refugees, Vietnamese in the 80s and 90s, Somalis more recently, Burmese more recently. And it was originally an Italian neighborhood which was very vibrant and thrived in a pretty strong working class neighborhood. So some of the efforts that grassroots groups are dealing with are how do you provide affordable housing in these communities when a lot of the housing, you know, most people have own houses, they need repairs, and if you don't make enough money to support your family, you can't repair your house. So how do you help people repair housing? How do you rehab housing and keep it affordable for working families rather than gentrifying it? So the two clips I'm going to show you are from groups dealing with this. One is called Push Buffalo People United for Sustainable Housing on the west side, and then another group called Buffalo Reuse, which is located on the east side of Buffalo and is trying to train primarily teenagers from very poor families about how to preserve, save the wood, whatever's salvageable from the houses. And one of the neat things about Buffalo housing is that a lot of it was built in the 1880s, 90s, and turn of the century with really good quality wood. And so if you save the wood that's still good and you rehab the houses, you can use much better quality materials than you could afford to buy today, and at the same time you're providing jobs and training for people who would otherwise be discarded by the society and might end up in prison. There's also a very interesting efforts to provide, to develop urban farming and help the low-income neighborhoods which do not have supermarkets, but the local, gambling, fast food stores, get access to fresh foods and vegetables. The city of Buffalo just passed an ordinance where you can now have chickens, up to 6 chickens. But one effort on the west side is trying to teach teenagers how to do farming and how to get, how to grow food and get that food into the community. So they have a truck and they take the food around and sell it in the summer. They'll have a small business. And that's an effort to work with teenagers to give them something constructive to do, some kind of training in these areas.
So I'm going to try to help my
literature on the table, but I also have some DVDs to sell, which have two of these projects. An interesting story, Push Buffalo was featured in one of the Extreme Home Makeover missions. I don't know if anybody happened to see it, but a lot of the people who were featured in the story of Push were also featured in the Extreme Home Makeover. And the story revolves around a Jamaican single parent who works as a healthcare aide, and she bought a house on Buffalo's website and the owner covered up all the faults in it, and it turned out that it was really condemned, but he managed to sell it to her, and so struggling on her wages, there wasn't any way to rehab it.
That was
a, it's
just
not a
I was just wondering.
You didn't take it out.
Yeah. Okay. So it should
maybe you could get chapter 1.
Yeah.
Okay.
Does anyone have questions for the previous presenters?
I have a question for the lady who was just a comment who was doing the labor of Harvard. I read him quite differently from you and probably from most other people. But I kind of liked him a lot, but in a, not as literature, but more as a snapshot into a time frame. But, you know, around 6 months ago in a thing I read in this collection of short stories by Robert Tagore. And I was fascinated because all the stories are very, very short. They're like 2 pages long, and they were written for magazine. And he doesn't do a whole lot of character development. He just, he gives 2 characters, 2 sentences each, and then he throws an event on the page. And suddenly, these no-name pictures come alive, not because of the character, but because of the event. And he does it brilliantly, even though he doesn't really consider himself a short story, he did for fun, I guess, or he had an idea and he wanted to throw it on the page. But I think when I read Lynn with Harbor, I get that sense of trying to describe an event. And he chose people who were, what we call blue collar. But I don't think it's about blue collar people. I think it's about the event. And he just happened to have chosen them as props to describe the event.
A lot of the events that the show for the story to take from his life too, in his biography.
Yeah.
We certainly go to the events themselves. Okay. I guess I'd be a little differently.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see his story being just really plot driven.
Yeah, I mean, there's an ounce of flatness in his characterization which was deliberate.
Sure.
And, you know, there was his last, this lady, the other lady, showed up some pictures of those paintings of the photographs on the post office. The last one is particularly riveting to me, and I think was the best one of the lot, the one with the Holbrooks, the Native Americans being sold. And that was deliberately very flat. And I think the reason was he didn't want to give anything, he almost wanted to give it an impersonality, like a he didn't want to give, like you said about the absence of a political slant. He wanted to remove all of that and just say, you make your decisions based on all the evidence you see and don't take sides,
Yeah, the term that we used to describe his writing issue was minimalist.
Okay.
And that term kind of falls into dispute among Harvard critics, was he a minimalist or not? He had an editor that edited severely what his collection was about, what we talk about love. When you see his most stripped down stories, like the ones that I'm thinking that you're thinking of, sometimes it wasn't even Carver, it was more Lish, his editor. And later on in his career, he rewrote the stories and flushed them back out again. So it's interesting when you start talking about which Carver,
I'm not an expert, so you know him a lot.
No, but it's the reason, it's the minimalist.
Okay. I need to cut in, but we're running out of time. You missed fire now.
Thank you.
the crux of what Push is trying to accomplish is to change the idea of what it means to do successful economic development in Buffalo. What we'd like to see is the idea of development become more one of bringing real investments to people, to neighborhoods where real people live, in such a way that their quality of life is improved. Where I think there's kind of this false distinction between human development and economic development in this city and other cities. You know, we see them as part of the same process. Not developing people who live in the city, they're not developing anything.
Massachusetts Avenue, where we are right now, is really because of a microcosm of what's been going on here in the west side, west of the river, and really, you know, kind of indicative of what's been going on in the side of the border, right? Here's a holding ground, right? We're holding ground over here on the west side. Digging in deep, finding people out of the community to build the power and things that are going to be used. And that's where Push comes in. That's, you know, hopefully what we'll be able to make a mark and get people to see it,
when we started to put down roofs. This is one of the first streets we had on campus. We went door to door, asked the people pretty open-ended questions. You know, what do you think of the west side? What do you think of the street? You know, hopeful, are you cynical? Do you think that the positive change, what does the positive change mean to you?
So then,
Thank you.
to kind of see the way that we're working within the community for the residents and dealing with issues that the city wants. And the other great thing about it is the job training that not only kids get, but a number of the folks that work with Bush have been in prison. And in the U.S., it's really hard to get jobs if you've been in prison, but a lot of the kids are young, and so they have no future, and so they're getting the skills, they're helping create housing and rebuild the community. It's really, you know, it's really very impressive. So, if you're interested, I have these DVDs for sale, they're $10, and they also help with the support of three other organizations. And they're also online, about the holidays and other things. So, let's go back to questions.
Questions?
I was wondering how is the building place the unions responded to the question? Have there been any attempts to get them involved with any apprenticeships and stuff? And have there been any federal money for energy plants possibly?
Well, I don't know about the building trade, although when they did the extreme home makeover, which is the Jamaican woman's house that they did have a contractor who worked with the community, and they also ended up doing a lot of community rehab at the same time they worked on some other people's houses, until they estimated $1,000 doing it. So it didn't involve the building trades. The building trades could never get work, this kind of work. People just don't have the money for it. So it's not like they're taking jobs.
No, but I mean, did they help?
Oh, I don't know. They
just volunteers, or,
yeah, I don't know if they actually. That's an interesting question. They didn't go to the building trades, as far as I know. But oh, yeah. It was a great question.
Other questions?
A question about alcohol power. What's being done to diversify the economic base?
That's actually a very hotly contested issue at the moment, because New York State has what's called Empire Development Zone. And what are the problems? And if we get money to build, sort of develop businesses, we get tax rebates to develop businesses. The problem with them is that they recruit jobs, say, from Buffalo to the suburbs, and then they get the tax breaks and subsidies. So what we're trying, some
in Buffalo though.
Yeah. Or when they recruit a job from somewhere else to the suburbs, usually very few businesses are willing to locate in the city just because there are very prosperous neighborhoods in the city. And in fact, one was voted one of the 10 best neighborhoods to live in the U.S. a few years ago. It's a great model of local economic development, small stores, restaurants, rehab houses, right in the middle-income operation neighborhood. So the attempt is to try to reform that so that companies that get subsidies actually have to create new jobs. They want them to pay living wages, which in Buffalo would be poverty level for families of three, and to, you know, not take jobs from one community and put it into another and get the tax subsidy. We really want a total increase in jobs, and that's very difficult. We just there's a plan to develop the waterfront and they'll bring in a Bass Pro sporting goods store. So it's very hotly contested because retail is a low-wage occupation. Why would you recruit a business that pays minimum wage and give them tax subsidies to anchor your waterfront when it's not good? It's like foolish economic development, but that's the big city mayor-sponsored, city-sponsored, business community-sponsored economic development plan. We were able to get the Buffalo Common Council to pass a resolution saying that any jobs created on the waterfront development have to have living wage. Yeah, which for Buffalo is like $10 an hour, so it's poverty level for a family of three. And the business community said this is a non we going to be able to get economic development that pays above poverty level wages that will actually increase jobs and opportunities? The university has an economic development strategy to build a healthcare corridor, and it's involved with a lot of, it's a public university, so that's another very hotly contested issue because their economic development strategy is to create a lot of flexibility that we think in the end would eliminate union jobs on the campus so that the faculty would go from having tenure-track jobs to being at-will employees or slightly under tenure-track. But at the same time, you're talking about expanding the university by 10,000, creating a healthcare corridor, creating a lot of high-paying healthcare jobs to Western Buffalo. So most people support it and don't pay attention to the downsides and flexibility. The other part of the flexibility legislation, once the university-owned property comes off the tax roll, so it ends up costing citizens more, it will further reduce the tax base, and any of the economic developments that bring in outside businesses onto the campus, they're no longer paying taxes, so that further reduces the tax roll. So most people don't pay attention to those kinds of details, so they hear more jobs, economic development, let's go for it. And then our union, the university, United University employees, just told you that people think the union is an idiot. And backward, because they're trying to create quality, you know, want guarantees for quality jobs, tenure track jobs for faculty, and so on. If they want the building that gives no guarantee that the building that will be done, that it's proposed to be, will be a union wage. So we're also concerned about that. So it's very, you know, it's hotly contested.
Other questions? Other answers?
Oh, just one more question. Is the post office, did you feel like the post office, the administration, or anything doing the project, do they have any funds for the student programs in the house? Because I do work in the post office. We had a
Yeah, no, there has been. There's an organization, the PARPA Conservation Group, and they're going around and conserving a lot of the post office murals. So it doesn't come out of the post office budget, but this other, through the government is supporting, but there's this organization that's going around and conserving them. And one, the Holbrook one that I showed at the end, that one of the images I had was pre-conservation and the close-up was conservation now. So, yeah, they are definitely restoring them. And so if somebody at the post office gets the letter in, they can possibly get it.
The Holbrook one was falling apart and had water damage.
Yeah.
And had ceiling and stuff. So it was really in need of some significant repair, which was done about 7 or 8 years ago. I don't think it came
out. Yeah, it was flaking off the wall. Even the one in Milton, which is, you know, relatively affluent community, yes, flaking.
There's a firm that does it in doing research. I can't remember the name of the firm. Is it okay? They've done a couple I came across.
Across the country, they're going all over.
Yeah, I think they're located actually in Cleveland or something. It's their home base.
That was
karma.
I thought that I'd bring you the letters. I thought it was
karma.
It's hard to track.
Painted over and or the buildings have been destroyed. Right. They just got destroyed with the building.
Yeah.
And some were just wrecked, you know, through maybe ceiling or what have you.
It's really hard to move a mural too. If they were on campus then they could have been rolled up, and sometimes like they've been moved and now they're over at a schoolhouse that used to be the post office. So you find strange places and they could be rolled up somewhere.
Yeah. Probably in the National Archives, some basement.